Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing, and now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino-style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere, and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
The Scottsboro boys were 9 African-American teenagers aged 12 to 19 accused in Alabama of raping 2 white women in 1931. The landmark set a legal case for this incident. It dealt with racism and the right to a fair trial. The cases included lynch mobs before the suspects had been all indicted. This is their story, the story of the Scottsboro boys today on The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Part 2 of the Scottsboro Boys. The 8 convicted defendants were assembled on April 9th, 1931, and sentenced to death by electric chair. The Associated Press reported that the defendants were calm and stoic as Judge Hawkins handed down the death sentences one after another. Judge Hawkins set the executions for July 10, 1931, the earliest date Alabama law allowed. While appeals were filed, the Alabama Supreme Court issued indefinite stays of execution 72 hours before the defendants were scheduled to die. The men's cells were next to the execution chamber, and they heard the July 10, 1931 execution of William Hoakes, a black man from St. Clair County convicted of murder. They later recalled that he died hard. After a demonstration in Harlem, the Communist Party USA took an interest in the Scottsboro case. Chattanooga Party member James Allen edited the Communist Southern Worker and publicized the plight of the boys. The party used its legal arm, the International Labor Defense, to take up their cases and persuaded the defendants' parents to let the party champion their cause. The ILD retained attorneys George W. Chamley, who filed the first motions, and Joseph Brodsky. The NAACP also offered to handle the case, offering the services of famed criminal defense attorney Clarence Darrow. However, the Scottsboro defendants decided to let the ILD handle their appeal. Chamley moved for new trials for all defendants. Private investigators took place, revealing that Price and Bates had been prostitutes in Tennessee who regularly serviced both black and white clientele. Chamley offered Judge Hawkins affidavits to that fact, but the judge forbade him to read them out loud. The defense argued that this evidence proved that the two women had likely lied at trial. Chamley pointed to the uproar in Scottsboro that occurred when the verdicts were reported as further evidence that the change of venue should have been granted. Following Judge Hawkins' denial of the motions for a new trial, attorney George W. Chamley filed an appeal and was granted a stay of execution. Chamley was joined by Communist Party attorney Joseph Brodsky and ILD attorney Irving Schwab. The defense team argued that their clients had not had adequate representation, had insufficient time for counsel to prepare their cases, had their juries intimidated by the crowd, and finally that it was unconstitutional for blacks to have been excluded from the jury. In questions of procedural errors, the state Supreme Court found none. On March 24, 1932, the Alabama Supreme Court ruled against 7 of the 8 remaining Scottsboro boys, confirming the convictions and death sentences of all but the 13-year-old Eugene Williams. It upheld 7 of 8 rulings from the lower court. The Alabama Supreme Court granted 13-year-old Eugene Williams a new trial because he was a juvenile, which saved him from the immediate threat of the electric chair. Weems and Norris ruling. The court upheld the lower court's change of venue decision, upheld the testimony of Ruby Bates, and reviewed the testimony of the various witnesses. As to the newly discovered evidence, the court ruled there is no contention on the part of the defendants that they had sexual intercourse with the alleged victim with her consent, so the defendants would not be granted a new trial. As to representation, the court found that the defendants were represented by counsel who thoroughly cross-examined the state's witness and presented such evidence as was available. Again, the court affirmed these convictions as well. The Alabama Supreme Court affirmed 7 of the 8 convictions and rescheduled the executions. So that's where we're at here in the case of the Scottsboro Boys, Part 2. On the dark side of Wikipedia, this will likely be a 3-parter because this is a very long entry and a lot of moving parts with the story. If you like our program, press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. And if you really like it, you want to get access to our episodes ad-free and get the final chapter segments and get advanced episodes to binge away on when you can't get them yet publicly, go and over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/darkside of Wikipedia to get access to all of that. It's Tony and Sean with you on today's episode of the program. Thoughts thus far on our part two?
It's just interesting how something that has come to light in such recent years, imagine the scrutiny and, I mean, we're talking about the 1930s. Mm-hmm. And this is a example of so much less reporting, social media, people's opinions. I mean, the fact that they even made it through this trial without being killed by members of the public is surprising.
I think it's interesting how the Communist Party steps in because, I mean, today it's like, the what? The Communist Party stepped in? But at that point in time, it was, I guess, a lot more of an accepted political viewpoint out in the open. Never in the U.S. being, you know, the main big one or anything like that. But still had a, you know, nobody today says I'm a communist. I mean, or very few people do. At that point in time, several did. And it was just kind of like, oh, that's their thing, you know.
And after, this is a situation where I think the ruling at the beginning of the trial, it was already set how they were going to find these individuals, and just excited to see how this turns out ultimately.
Yeah. Now let's continue into the story here. Chief Justice John C. Anderson dissented, agreeing with the defense in many of its motions. Anderson stated that the defendants had not been accorded a fair trial and strongly dissented to the decision to affirm their sentences. He wrote, "While the Constitution guarantees to the accused a speedy trial, it is of greater importance that it should be by a fair and impartial jury, a jury free from bias or prejudice, and above all, from coercion and intimidation." He pointed out that the National Guard had shuttled the defendants back and forth each day from jail, and that the fact alone was enough to have coercive effect on the jury. Anderson criticized how the defendants were represented. He noted that Roddy declined to appear as appointed counsel and did so only under force. He continued, "These defendants were confined in a jail in another county, and local counsel had little opportunity to prepare their defense. Moreover, they would have been represented by able counsel had a better opportunity been given. Justice Anderson also pointed out the failure of the defense to make closing arguments as an example of underzealous defense representation. About the courtroom outburst, Justice Anderson noted that there was a great applause, and this was bound to have influence. Anderson noted that the punishment for rape ranged between 10 years and death. Some of the teenagers should have been found less culpable than others and therefore should have received lighter sentences. Anderson concluded, no matter how revolting the accusation, how clear the proof, or how degraded or even brutal the offender, the Constitution, the law, and the very genius of Anglo-American liberty demanded a fair and impartial trial. The case went to the United States Supreme Court on October 10, 1932, amidst tight security. The ILD retained Walter Pollock to handle the appeal. The Attorney General of Alabama, Thomas E. Knight, represented the state. Pollock argued that the defendants had been denied due process, first, due to the mob atmosphere, and second, because of the strange attorney appointed and their poor performance at trial. Last, he argued that African Americans were systematically excluded from jury duty, contrary to the 14th Amendment. Knight countered that there had been a mob atmosphere at the trial and pointed to the finding that by the Alabama Supreme Court that the trial had been fair and representation able. He told the court that he had no apologies to make. In a landmark decision, the United States Supreme Court reversed the convictions on the ground that the Due Process Clause of the United States Constitution guarantees the effective assistance of counsel at a criminal trial. And, an opinion written by Associate Justice George Sutherland, the court found that the defendants had been denied effective counsel. Chief Justice Anderson's previous dissent was quoted repeatedly in this decision. The court did not fault Moody or Roddy for lack of an effective defense, noting that both had told Judge Hawkins that they had not had time to prepare their cases. They said the problem was with the way Judge Hawkins immediately hurried the trial. This conclusion did not find the Scottsboro defendants innocent, but ruled that the procedures violated their rights to due process under the 5th and 14th Amendments. The Supreme Court sent the case back to Judge Hawkins for a retrial. When the case, by now a cause celebrate, came back to Judge Hawkins, he granted the request for a change of venue. The defense had urged for a move to the city of Birmingham, Alabama, but the case was transferred to a small rural community of Decatur. This was near the homes of the alleged victims and in Ku Klux Klan territory. The American Communist Party maintained control over the defense of the case, retaining the New York criminal defense attorney Samuel Leibowitz. He had never lost a murder trial and was a registered Democrat with no connection to the Communist Party. They kept Joseph Brudsky as their second chair for the trial. The case was assigned to District Judge James Edwin Horton and tried in Morgan County. His appointment to the case drew local praise. Nevertheless, the judge carried a loaded pistol in his car throughout the time he presided over the cases. The 2 years that had passed since the first trials had not dampened community hostility for the Scottsboro Boys, but others believed they were victims of Jim Crow justice, and the case was covered by numerous national newspapers. At the trial, some 100 reporters were seated at the press tables, hundreds more gathered on the courthouse lawn. National Guard members in plain clothes mingled in the crowd looking for any sign of trouble. The sheriff's department brought the defendants to court in a patrol wagon guarded by two carloads of deputies armed with automatic shotguns. In the courtroom, the Scottsboro Boys sat in a row wearing blue prison denims and guarded by National Guardsmen, except for Roy Wright, who had not been convicted. Wright wore street clothes. The Birmingham News described him as dressed up like a Georgia gigolo. Leibowitz asserted his trust in the God-fearing people of Decatur and Morgan County. He made a pretrial motion to quash the indictment on the ground that blacks had been systematically excluded from the grand jury. Although the motion was denied, this got the issue in the record for future appeals. To this motion, Attorney General Thomas Knight responded, "The state will concede nothing. Put on your case." Leibowitz called the editor of the Scottsboro Weekly newspaper, who testified that he'd never heard of a black juror in Decatur because they all steal. He called local jury commissioners to explain the absence of African Americans from Jackson County juries. When Leibowitz accused him of excluding black men from juries, they did not seem to understand his accusation. It was as if the exclusion was so ordinary as to be unconscious. Note, since most blacks could not vote after having been disenfranchised by the Alabama Constitution, the local jury commissioners probably never thought about them as potential jurors who were limited voters. Leibowitz called local black professionals as witnesses to show they were qualified for jury service. Leibowitz called John Sanford, an African-American of Scottsboro, who was educated, well-spoken, and respected. The defense attorney showed that Mr. Sanford was evidently qualified in all manner, except by virtue of his race, to be a candidate for participation in a jury. During the following cross-examination, Knight addressed the witness by his first name, John. The first two times that he did so, Leibowitz asked the court to have him alter his behavior. He did not, and the insult eventually caused Leibowitz to leap to his feet, saying, "Now listen, Mr. Attorney General, I've warned you twice about your treatment of my witness. For the last time now, stand back, take your finger out of his eye, and call him Mr.," causing gasps from the public seated in the gallery. The judge abruptly interrupted Leibowitz. When the pretrial motion to quash the indictment was denied, Leibowitz had positioned the case for appeal. The issue of the composition of the jury was addressed in a second landmark decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, which ruled that race could not be used to exclude anyone from candidacy for participation in a jury anywhere in the United States. This astonished and infuriated many residents of Alabama and many other southern states. It makes me so excited to be traveling to the South in the next week reading this, because I don't know that in many areas that this is all that different in terms of attitude. I'm not saying every area, but there's a lot of areas where this sort of just, like they described it here, where one of the newspaper guy goes, "Because the blacks steal," and they're like, "What do you mean by that? What do you mean? What do I mean by that?" It's just to them, it's like it's a across the board fact, and there's no other way of looking at things. That to me is just so scary that people can think in that sort of manner. And I hopefully it's improved a bit over the years, but I don't know. I mean, there's still a lot of this stuff that goes on. Maybe not necessarily in court, but
I'm excited for part three to be recorded on site when you are in Alabama. Interesting.
We'll go to the courthouse steps and discuss this, and then I'll get
your
shot.
Your Honor, yes, this is called a podcast. You put these headphones on and you just discuss what your brother and did 80 years ago. This is the situation, I think, when you're growing up and your parents say something and you just believe them because they're your parents. You don't necessarily question them. There's a lot of, well, this is how it is because this is how it is. Well, why do you say that? What do you mean, why do I say that?
Yeah.
Look at the color of their skin.
Jeez. Yeah.
Clearly they did this. This is just, as we find out more and more details, it's just sad that, there was no rebuttal. There was no, okay, you actually need to support all of your claims here with actual evidence. This is purely opinion.
Yeah.
And we are getting fucked in this situation.
You know, it's just an interesting thing to look at, because we look at things today and the complete denial of facts that are going on, and we think it's very much a today problem. There's always been this problem of people just denying reality and denying facts and basing their set of facts on what their pappy told them or what they, these weird beliefs and based it on emotion and fear, but not facts. It was going on back then and it's going on today. And I don't know if we are much more aware of it today, because things can be amplified so much more through things like social media. And you can, in 2 seconds, go and flip through thousands of strangers' opinions and just see it all out in the open. And in the past, you'd actually have to go talk to somebody. You know, there's this stream of consciousness that's documented left and right everywhere now. And I think we're really just seeing everybody's crazy out there in the open in such a platform, in a way that we never really did, other than just in settings where it was like a mob.
I'm okay going back to the 30s so I didn't have to see the garbage. I'm more than okay with that.
And it's not in any way to say that things were better, but it's in a way of saying that we weren't so exposed to everybody's crazy, I guess, out there in the open where it can just tear away at you day after day going, what the fuck is wrong with people? You know?
If you let it.
If you let it. True. True.
Which is interesting in and of itself, where people, oh my gosh, there's so much this, that, or the other. You literally have an app downloaded on your phone that you tapped with your thumb and you're scrolling for 4 hours and going to bed at 3 a.m. Why are you telling me this? Hold it down for 3 seconds. There's a little X in the top of the app. Delete it from your phone and don't look.
Yeah, it is a choice.
Oh, well, I didn't think of that.
It's completely a choice. But I think for many of us, it's like, well, I think the initial reaction is, well, the good outweighs the bad. I don't know. That's always the truth. You know, there's certainly some good there, but there's a lot of bad. I don't know. I mean, when I'm on social media these days, I don't even, if I see something that somebody says that's utterly crazy, there's no arguing it. I just simply go unfriend. And I that's how I try to control it. But, you know, it's people sneak in there. And sometimes people that you thought were different are not so different. And they surprise you every now and then. But I have no qualms about getting rid of virtually anyone that says something really out there that's just morally wrong or just so misinformed that it's like, okay, this has been fun, but goodbye.
The overabundance of the all that social media is, and people that allow it to overtake them, is the equivalent of, oh, my left lung is not working. Why on earth is that happening? Well, you do know that you've smoked 2 packs a day for the last 34 years, right? But I'm not aware of why my... So,
yeah,
that's... And ultimately, what it comes down to is we are all creatures of wanting to learn, and we all want to know about others. That's just how we're programmed as humans, clearly. Yeah. If we weren't like that, everybody that we see down the street would be strangers. But you want to learn, and that's not a bad thing. It's just because there is free range, as though we are cattle out in the field doing whatever, however, whenever, all of our different views and opinions are in one big ass fishbowl, and there's no way for us to hide what we want to see and we don't. And I think it's very easy for us to be overwhelmed and consumed. So it's just, as you said, it's a choice. And I think what starts as good in wanting to learn about others and to offer all of our opinions, when it just gets too much, it's too much for our brains to digest. And that's where the negative starts to ooze out and then overtakes the whole darn thing.
Yeah, I think you...
With that being said, allow me to check my Facebook cold, please.
Let's go on to our next section. Judge Horton called the first case against Haywood Patterson and began jury selection. Leibowitz objected that African-American jurors had been excluded from the jury pool. He called the jury commissioner to the stand, asking if there were any blacks on the juror rolls. And when told yes, suggested his answer was not honest. The locals resented his questioning of the official and chewed their tobacco meditatively. The National Guard posted 5 men with fixed bayonets in front of Leibowitz's residence that night. The jury was selected by the end of the day on Friday and sequestered in the Lyons Hotel. A large crowd gathered outside the courthouse for the start of the Patterson trial on Monday, April 2nd. Without the vivid detail she had used in the Scottsboro trials, Victoria Price told her account in 16 minutes. The defense had what she said before under oath on paper and could confront her with any inconsistencies. The only drama came when Knight pulled a torn pair of step-ins from his briefcase and tossed him into the lap of a juror to support the claim of rape. Leibowitz used a 32-foot model train set up in the table in front of the witness stand to illustrate where each of the parties was during the alleged events. The other points of his defense. When asked if the model in front of her was like the train where she claimed she was raped, Price cracked, "It was bigger, lots bigger. That's a toy." Leibowitz later conceded that Price was one of the toughest witnesses he ever cross-examined. Her answers were evasive and derisive. She often replied, "I can't remember," or "I won't say." Once when Leibowitz confronted her with the contradiction in her testimony, she exclaimed, sticking a finger in the direction of the defendant Patterson, "One thing I will never forget is that one sitting right there raped me." The attorney tried to question her about a conviction for fornication and adultery in Huntsville, but the court sustained a prosecution objection. Price insisted that she had spent the evening before the alleged rape at the home of Miss Callie Brioche in Chattanooga. Leibowitz asked her whether she had spent an evening in a hobo jungle in Huntsville, Alabama, where a Lester Carter and Jack Tiller, but she denied it. Leibowitz said that Callie Brioche was a fictional character in a Saturday Evening Post short story and suggested that Price's stay with her had been equally fictional. And the historian James Goodman wrote, "Price was not the first hardened witness Leibowitz had faced, and certainly not the most depraved. Nor was she the first witness who tried to stare him down and, failing that, who seemed as if she were about to leap out of her seat and strike him. She was not the first witness to be evasive, sarcastic, and crude. She was, however, the first witness to use her bad memory and total lack of refinement, and at times even ignorance, to great advantage. Many of the whites in the courtroom likely resented Leibowitz as a Jew from New York hired by the communists for his treatment of a Southern white woman, even a low-class one, as a hostile witness. Some wondered if there was any way he could leave Decatur alive. The National Guard Captain Joe Burleson promised Judge Horton that he would protect Leibowitz and the defendants as long as we have a piece of ammunition or a man alive. Once Captain Burleson learned that the group was on their way to take care of Leibowitz, he raised the drawbridge across the Tennessee River, keeping them out of Decatur. Judge Horton learned that the prisoners were in danger from locals. Once he sent out the jury and warned the courtroom, "I want it to be known that these prisoners are under the protection of this court. The court intends to protect these prisoners and any other persons engaged in this trial." Threats of violence came from the North as well. One letter from Chicago read, "When these boys are dead, within 6 months, your state will lose 500 lives. Leibowitz systematically dismantled each prosecution witness's story under cross-examination. He got Dr. Bridges to admit on cross-examination that the best you can say about the whole case is that both these women showed they had sexual intercourse. Paint Rock ticket agent W.H. Hill testified to seeing the woman and the black youth in the same car, but on cross-examination admitted to not seeing the woman at all until they got off the train. Posse member Tom Russo claimed to have seen the women and youths get off the same car, but under cross-examination admitted finding the defendants scattered in various cars at the front of the train. Lee Adams testified that he had seen the fight, but later saying that he was a quarter mile from the tracks. Ori Dobbins repeated that he'd seen the women try to jump off the train, but Leibowitz showed photos of the positions of the parties that proved Dobbins could not have seen everything he claimed. Dobbins insisted he had seen the girls wearing women's clothing, but other witnesses had testified they were in overalls. The prosecution withdrew the testimony of Dr. Marvin Lynch, the other examining doctor, as repetitive. Many years later, Judge Horton said that Dr. Lynch confided that the women had not been raped and had laughed when he examined them. He said that if he testified for the defense, his practice in Jackson County would be over. Thinking Patterson would be acquitted, Judge Horton did not force Dr. Lynch to testify, but the judge had become convinced the defendants were innocent. Leibowitz began his defense by calling Chattanooga resident Dallas Ramsey, who testified that his home was next to the hobo jungle mentioned earlier. He said that he had seen both Price and Bates get on the train there with a white man on the morning of the alleged rape. Train fireman Percy Ricks testified that he saw the two women slipping along the side of the train right after it stopped in Paint Rock as if they were trying to escape the posse. Leibowitz put on the testimony of Chattanooga gynecologist Dr. Edward A. Reisman, who testified that after the woman had been raped by six men, it was impossible that she would have only a trace of semen, as was found in this case. Leibowitz next called Lester Carter, a white man who testified that he had intercourse with Bates. Jack Tiller, another white, said he had had sex with Price 2 days before the alleged rapes. He testified that he had been on the train on the morning of the arrest. He'd heard Price ask Orville Gilley, a white youth, to confirm that she had been raped. However, Gilly had told her to go to hell. Morgan County Solicitor Wade Wright cross-examined Carter. Wright tried to get Carter to admit that the Communist Party had bought his testimony, which Carter denied. But he said that the defense attorney, Joseph Brodsky, had paid his rent and bought him a new suit for the trial. Five of the original nine Scottsboro defendants testified that they had not seen Price or Bates until after the train stopped in Paint Rock. Willie Robertson testified that he was suffering from syphilis with sores that prevented him from walking and that he was in a car at the back of the train. Olin Montgomery testified he had been alone in the tank car the entire trip and had not known about the fight or alleged rapes. Ozzie Powell said that while he was not a participant, he had seen the fight with the white teenagers from his vantage point between a boxcar and a gondola car where he had been hanging on. He said he saw the white teenagers jump off the train. Roberson, Montgomery, and Powell all denied they had known each other or the other defendants before that day. Andy Wright, Eugene Williams, and Haywood Patterson testified that they had previously known each other but had not seen the woman until the train stopped in Paint Rock. Knight questioned them extensively about instances in which their testimony supposedly differed from their testimony at the trial in Scottsboro. They did not contradict themselves in any meaningful way. Haywood Patterson testified on his own behalf that he had not seen the women before stopping in Paint Rock. He withstood a cross-examination from Knight, who shouted, shook his finger at, and ran back and forth in front of the defendant. At one point, Knight demanded, "You were tried at Scottsboro?" Patterson snapped. "I was framed at Scottsboro," Knight thundered. "Who told you to say that?" Patterson replied, "I told myself to say it." Just after the defense rested with reservations, someone handed Leibowitz a note. The attorneys approached the bench for a hushed conversation, which was followed by a short recess. Leibowitz called one final witness thus far in the trial. Ruby Bates had been notably absent. She had disappeared from her home in Huntsville weeks before the new trial, and every sheriff in Alabama had been ordered to search for her to no avail. Now two guardsmen with bayonets opened the courtroom door, and Bates entered in stylish clothes, eyes downcast. Her dramatic and unexpected entrance drew stares from the residents of the courtroom. Victoria Price, brought out for Bates to identify, glared at her. Attorney General Knight warned Price to keep your temper. Bates proceeded to testify and explained that no rape had occurred. She said none of the defendants had touched her or even spoken to her. When asked if she had been raped on March 25, 1931, Bates said, "No, sir." When asked why she had initially said she had been raped, Bates replied, "I told it just like Victoria did because she said we might have to stay in jail if we did not frame up a story after crossing a state line with men." Bates explained that Price had said she didn't care if all the Negroes in Alabama were put in jail. This recantation seemed to be a severe blow to the prosecution. Bates admitted having intercourse with Lester Carter in the Huntsville railway yards 2 days before making accusations. Finally, she testified she'd been in New York City and had decided to return to Alabama to tell the truth after urging Reverend Harry Emerson, a Fosdick of that city. With his eye turned to the Southern jury, Knight cross-examined her. He noted her stylish dress and demanded where she had gotten the fine clothes. When she responded that the Communist Party had paid for her clothes, any credibility she had with the jury was destroyed. Judge Horton warned spectators to stop laughing at her testimony or he would eject them. By the time Leibowitz closed, the prosecution had employed anti-Semitic remarks to discredit him. Wade Wright added to this, referring to Ruby's boyfriend Lester Carter as Mr. Kardinsky and called him the prettiest Jew he ever saw. He said, "Don't you know these defense witnesses are bought and paid for? May the Lord have mercy on the soul of Ruby Bates. Now the question in this case is justice in the case going to be brought and sold in Alabama with Jew money from New York?" Leibowitz objected and moved for a new trial. Judge Horton refused to grant a new trial, telling the jury to put the remarks out of your minds. One author describes Wright's closing arguments as the now famous Jew-baiting summary to the jury. He goes on to say that until Wright spoke, many of the newspaper men felt that there was an outside chance for acquittal, at least for a hung jury. But from then on, the defense was helpless. In his closing, Leibowitz called Wright's argument an appeal to regional bigotry, claiming talk about communists was just to befuddle the jury. He described himself as a patriot, a Roosevelt Democrat, who had served the Stars and Stripes in World War I. when there was no talk of Jew or Gentile, white or black. As to Wright's reference to Jew money, Leibowitz said that he was defending the Scottsboro boys for nothing and was personally paying the expenses of his wife, who had accompanied him. "I'm interested," Leibowitz argued, "solely in seeing that poor, moronic, colored boy over there and his co-defendants in the other case get a square shake of the dice, because I believe before God they are victims of a dastardly frame-up." He called Price's testimony a foul, contemptible, outrageous lie. He ended with the Lord's Prayer and a challenge to either acquit or render the death sentence, nothing in between. Attorney General Knight delivered his rebuttal, roaring that if the jury found Haywood not guilty, they ought to put a garland of roses around his neck, give him a supper, and send him to New York City. "Considering the evidence," he continued, "there can be but one verdict, death in the electric chair for raping Victoria Price." So that's where things sit in this just completely messed up story. Everything is said in court. I mean, so many just things playing on the racism of the time and of the area, just openly, just like, let's throw this out there. Let's rile up these people and get them all excited in their hate. And it just looked on like, that's cool. That's cool. That's what we do here.
So why did you make up the story and say that these guys raped you? Well, we thought we'd go to jail if we crossed a state line. I don't understand how that then means you have to make up a story saying they raped you.
Their thought was, you know, it was just completely narcissistic. It was completely, we're going to say whatever we need to say. And who cares what the consequences are for those people we accuse, as long as we don't get in trouble?
I mean, you could have said they kidnapped you. You could have said that they, you know, forced you against your will to get in their vehicle. Why go to the extent of raping?
It was probably just the easiest thing that would be believed without much question, unfortunately.
Hmm. Well, this is just, there are so many layers to try to, you make sense of one thing, which you could in this sense, where they're scared, they're young, they don't know. So that makes sense. But then you have all of the folks that are trying to put them away. I mean, they have to look into some type of evidence, or you would think, if you talk to the girls and they say, well, why'd you make that up? They find out why they made it up. Well, that right then there should vindicate all of them.
But because she was wearing fancy clothing, must not be true.
I would have a tough time if I were to be objectionary in this whole kerfuffle. I'd say bullshit, and we're done. Lunch meeting. Court is in recess.
Yeah.
There is no reason to come back here. We're done.
It's interesting. It's a case where up until this point, facts just didn't matter. You could have the people who were allegedly raped come out and say, no, that didn't happen. And it's still up in the air of like, did it happen? They're saying it didn't happen. The people who had this happen are saying, not true. But we think it would fit our agenda better if it was true. But it's not true. So you're not entitled to your own facts. And that's something that the human beings of this planet have a really hard time getting over. This idea that you can have an opinion, but you can't have your own facts. Facts are facts. And that still eludes so many.
And to them, there's a saying in the South. It's called bless it. Bless your heart.
Bless your heart.
It's not a compliment.
It's not a compliment.
It's not a compliment.
And, you know, not being from the South, I didn't know that for quite some time.
Bless your heart. Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yes, bless mine.
Yes, absolutely. That seems so nice that they said that.
No. You are dumb.
Yeah. It's like, wow. Well, that's interesting to hear. But there you go. That's where we're going to sit. The verdict is going to come up in part three of the story. So we'll get to that on our next episode of Dark Side of Wikipedia and close out the story of the Scottsboro Boys. If you like our program and you'd like access to all of our episodes, including jumping all the way to part three in advance of everybody else, become a Dark Sider. Patreon.com/Dark Side of Wikipedia to get in on that, get advanced episodes of the show. All of it's ad-free, and our entire archive, including all the final chapters, all there for you. Patreon.com/Dark Side of Wikipedia. Until next time, for Sean, I'm Tony. Thanks for listening to The Dark Side of Wikipedia.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.